Most of you know I went to Israel for the first time in my life a few weeks ago, and I just wanted to take opportunity a little bit this morning and probably next Sunday just to talk about some of the experiences I had and what it was like to go there. And I got some pictures to go along with it, and so we'll go ahead and if you can put that up there, Mike. This is the group I went with. It was all pretty much pastors from all over the nation. There was a children's pastor from Chicago. There was a lady who actually pastors a church whose husband passed away about a year ago. And she has now taken the church herself, an 18,000 member church, as a widow. These are amazing. Really just wonderful people of God from Atlanta, Alabama, some up in Buffalo, and just a group of people that Eagles Wings wanted to bring to show them what firsthand where God has worked and where He is now still working. And that's what we're going to be talking about. As I said, it was my first time. It was Tina's second time. She went a few years ago. That's her on the... That's the last time she was in Israel. She was 9 years old, and that was... And that is with Mom and Dad. And is that your aunt all the way on the right, Tina? Is that your Aunt Edith? So there's two Holocaust survivors in that picture, too. Her aunt actually fled Poland just before the blitzkrieg of September 1st of 1939, only to have her boat torpedoed by a U-boat, and they barely made it. But we got Tina back one more time, and she found the same camel. I didn't know they lived that long. Praise God. And just so you know, there are some other people from America that have made it to Israel as well. Mr. McDonald, KFC, and you know, there's one other person that's there. I didn't know it. I'm in Israel. I don't know if you noticed that, but see that? I don't even know what that is. All over Israel. I wanted to find out. I think it's a fast food restaurant or something. But anyway, I want to just talk a little bit about this wonderful, beautiful land. And you could go to the next picture there, Michael. Is that amazing? That is the Jezreel plain or valley. It's one of the most strategic sites in Israel. There have probably been more battles taken place in this site because it is so strategic than any other place in the world. Joshua fought the Canaanites who caused him to be forced back up into the mountains there. You could see that in Joshua 17. In the time of Judges, Deborah and Gideon had their battles in this basic area. Even all the way up to Napoleon had a battle in this valley in 1799. And even as recently as General Allenby in 1917 in World War I, it has always been territory and fought. And I don't want to, you know, over-sensationalize what it was like to be able to go to Israel. But I've got to tell you, there is something about going to the geographical centerpiece that God has chosen to communicate with humanity and carry out some of His most strategic plans, to actually go there, the spiritual hub of where this concept that wasn't even known, we're going to talk about that in a little bit, a concept of a single God, a monotheistic concept, mono, one God, was not even known. And out of this sprung the concept of that there's only one God for all people, which would make sense. And then, of course, there's been divisions on that one God, but still the concept and the three major religious expressions are still centered in the same geographic location and often have manifested themselves in frightening battles and warfare in the physical, visible realm, which is really, in many cases, just the manifestation of the invisible spiritual battle that's going on underneath it. I really believe that. I really do. And the experience is just inspiring and in many ways revelatory. So I just want to talk about some of those things and just to share what I experienced. And so I'm going to kind of just simply divide it up into yesterday and today, what God has done in the past there. We're going to talk a little bit about that. This morning, it'll be a little more informational, but I think it's going to help us get to a place where next week, I really want to talk about what I saw, and I'm not giving you some prophetic utterance or something, but I'll tell you what, all you have to do is open your eyes and take a look, and you can see that something big is on the horizon. You don't have to be a theological expert to really just see that there's some, you know, and there is something so valuable in a ministry like a Wayman that ministers to us because, you know what, people are beat up. They're wiped out. The fallen world has a way of just wiping people out. And so we desperately need ministries like what Wayman has to minister to us personally and give people hope that there's a God that is crazy about you and He wants to help you through and He's got a plan and a purpose for you. But I think there's also a time as Christians where we need to allow ourselves to get back and out of our own personal mess and understand that God has something even bigger going on a global scale, and you're part of it. It's a big church, and exciting things are going on. One of the ways I heard it explained, I think, was that, you know, it's like God's sovereign plan. And, of course, there's arguments, well, does God, you know, do it all, or do we have free will? And one way I like to look at it is God is like a huge cruise ship that somebody has already designated that it's going from New York to London. And that's where it's going, and it's headed there. Now, on that cruise ship, there are all these passengers, and they have the free will to choose whatever they want to do. They want to go up on the upper deck, or they want to take a nap, or go wherever they want on the ship. But the overall plan of the ship is still heading on the destiny that God has planned. And I'll tell you what, God has a destiny. And we know that in the Bible, but when you go there and you see what's going on, you start to get excited that, you know what? It's not just some theological classroom religious stuff, but it's going on and He's as real and working within humanity as He was centuries ago that we read about. I like the fact that they are just plain physical historical locations that you read in the Bible. You know, back in Old Testament times, before Christ, going back centuries, all of the other religions, their mythology was always based in completely fictitious areas, fictitious characters, fictitious activities that took place, but completely contrary to the norm of religions of that day is the Hebrews religion, and all the stories are in actual historical, geographical, historically verifiable locations with historically verifiable characters. They're not made-up locations. They're still there today. And yet interjected in the midst of these very accurate historical accounts are supernatural happenings that challenge our rational minds. That is there something greater? Is there a bigger story? Is there a God that's capable of intervening? Is He working something greater than just working and working and doing errands and then after about 70, 80 years it's over? Is there a grander plan? And so I just want to start off by where God started this whole new nation and epoch and community of believers. So turn to Genesis chapter 12. The directive. It happened thousands of years ago. The proximity of the date is about 2000 BC. About 4,000 years ago. Chapter 12 is verse 1. And the Bible is saying that the Lord is speaking to somebody. Now it says that the Lord said to Abram. It doesn't say how he said it. What I like about God is that he's not confined to circumstances like I am. The only way you can know what I'm thinking right now is I have to use my mouth and articulate what's going on in my head with my tongue. I make noises that form words, go into your ears, and then you hear it and you know what's going on in my head. I'm dependent on sound waves carrying these words into your head so you can know what I'm thinking. God isn't boss. Guess what? He has direct access to your mind. And what we need to learn is how to discern when those thoughts that are coming in are my own, or there is a very good possibility it could be God placing thoughts, having direct access to my mind. Now, God spoke to Abraham. Could have been audibly, but perhaps Abram was such a lover of God. He was referred to as a friend of God. He had developed. He's 75 years old now. Let me tell you something. I'm so glad to say this at 52. There's something good about getting old in God. You know, maybe my muscles are atrophying, but my spiritual muscles are growing stronger day by day. Paul says the outward man perishes, but the inward man is strengthened. You learn how to discern whether it's just a thought because you had a bad pork chop, which Abram have had by didn't have the kosher law yet, but he knew how to discern when it was something like that or if it was really God speaking. And he was absolutely sure that God was speaking, that this wasn't just his own head. Chapter 12, verse 1. Now the Lord said to Abram, go forth from your country. You know where his country was? Iraq. You know, Iraq is mentioned in the Bible second only to Israel. God's done a lot of work in that place. Do you pray for Iraq? We're supposed to pray for Israel and the peace of Jerusalem, but might it be a bad idea to pray for countries that are mentioned almost as much? Where the father of our faith came from originally. God spoke to him in Iraq. Imagine that. Go forth from your country and from your relatives now and from your dad's house to a land that I'm going to show you. And I'm going to make you a great nation. I'm going to bless you. I will make your name great, and so you shall be a blessing. See that? He's not just doing it so he can have a big head. He's doing it because he wants to use him as a conduit to be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and the one who curses you, I will curse. And in you, all the families of the earth will be blessed. We've only seen the first microcosm of that begin to happen. Where through the birth of Jesus Christ, relationship with the God of Abraham is available to all. But I think there's a much bigger explosive manifestation of that blessing that has yet to be seen. Verse 4, so Abram went forth as the Lord had spoken to him. That's what I loved about Wayman. He seems to be able to know when it's not his thoughts. I think sometimes maybe we need to just step out and see. What if God tells me to go wash somebody's feet? And he really wasn't God and it was me. What's the big deal? So they look at you weird. But what if it is God and something like what happened to Wayman goes down? How are we going to learn the voice of God? Abram learned to hear the voice of God, and the Lord had spoken to him, verse 4. And so he brought his nephew Lot with him. Now Abram was, here it is, 75 years old when he departed from Haran. Abram took Sarai, his wife, and Lot, his nephew, and all their possessions they had, what they had accumulated, and the persons which they had acquired in Haran, and they set out for the land of Canaan. Thus they came to the land of Canaan. Abram passed through the land as far as the site of Shechem to the oak of Moriah. Now the Canaanite was in the land. And the Lord appeared to Abram and said, to your descendants I will give this land. To your descendants I will give this land. So he built an altar there to the Lord who had appeared to him. This is just wild stuff. A little band of people that descended from a little nomadic desert group of people from modern-day Iraq. And Abram and his wife Sarai head out there, and this story was kept for centuries, probably for some time by oral tradition. You know, did you ever think that probably one of the most coolest inventions was writing? You know, it wasn't always writing. People had to depend on their memory. That's scary, isn't it? And so somebody came up with the idea of writing down symbols so that we could have a permanent record of whatever it is that we want to record accurately. But it's also amazing, and you're going to see a little later, how effective and how accurate perhaps oral tradition was at one point, because that was the only way to pass down facts and historical events. So he started out, he gave this story, and then his Isaac would tell the next, and then the next, and so forth, and then eventually it was documented and written down in what we know today as the Bible. And the story was carried down, and then it began to be known as Abraham, as we know. His name was changed to Father of Many Nations, and Sarah, noble woman or mother of nations. And they received this directive from God to go to a particular location to be a physical witness to the world of the God of the universe. The critical fertile crescent, as it's called, that was really the crossroads of the ancient world that people would come through and they would see if what it was like. And a witness that would be a shocking, as I said, to the known world. You have to understand something. A book I have, Thomas Cahill, it's called The Gifts of the Jews. And he does, a fantastic job of just trying to get us to understand that it's almost impossible for us to conceive of a world that doesn't have Jewish influence. The way we are so affected by the spiritual understanding and concepts of God, especially in our Western world. His subtitle of the book says, How a Tribe of Desert Nomads Changed the Way Everyone Thinks and Feels. We don't really realize the magnitude of that. He goes on to say that our culture and civilization has been so shaped by the Hebrew Scriptures that it's almost impossible to conceive how the words of the Bible and the testimony of the Jews have changed the world. There were a number of stories of how creation took place. And it was documented by this group of Hebrews that in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. That is the most controversial, perhaps even to this day, set of words that has ever been written. And at that time, it was absolutely shocking because nobody believed in a personal God that created everything. The whole concept was many gods. Not only not only that, but they believed that these gods were limited in power. They were morally fallible. These gods were petty and jealous with each other. If you read their stories, therefore they involve these crazy religious practices. Can you imagine? We live in a crazy world with a lot of self-centered, violent, just deplorable behavior, but at least believe that God is good. They lived in the same conditions, but they believed that the gods were just as bad. They were petty and jealous too. They were fighting amongst themselves. They were immorally infallible also. What kind of a culture and society does that develop? And then here comes this group of Jews to begin to say that, no, there's only one God. He's loving and he's created everything. In the midst of these people that have heard nothing but a group of gods that promote them to have these just gross, immoral sexual practices and even human sacrifice in an effort to manipulate the gods and gain their favor would often take place. So I want you to take a look at this next picture. This is a place where we went. You've probably heard of it. It's in the Bible. It's called Megiddo. This is an ancient altar, actually, that was uncovered there. This is believed to have been a settlement of Canaanites. They've unearthed the entryway, the gates, the old city gates, where very possibly Abraham may have walked through. This is a fascinating area. It's had civilizations live there, they think, as far back as 4,000 B.C. And Canaanites believed to be there somewhere around 2,000. And there's been so many people that live there, it's got 20 layers of civilizations that creates a little mini mountain or hill that you call in Hebrew a tell, that is 75 feet high and about 12 acres in circumference. And got things like this, where perhaps some of the efforts to manipulate the gods took place on that particular thing. And of course, one of the most predominant civilizations to live there throughout centuries was the Israelites. And Solomon is said to have built a temple here. In 1 Kings 9, it talks about that. It says the wall of Jerusalem, Hazar, and Megiddo. He built a levy to build walls there. And so they've unearthed an area where they think might have even been his stables. And this is a section of it here. They have a little horse so you can see. They've put things back in place so you can start to see how it was set up with the feeding troughs and so forth. An interesting thought we had was, you know, those feeding troughs were also called mangers. That's probably a lot closer to what Jesus was placed in, instead of the cute little wood thing with the hay in it, you know. Hewn out stone trough. They're always, these guys are, and I don't even know how they do it. It's fascinating, but how they figure out which era and everything. It's now believed that these stables were probably Ahab's, actually. They originally thought they were Solomon's. Now they're saying that they think it was probably Ahab. But be it as it may, it's just fascinating to see what God has just done throughout history. So many different people. And there's a few other things here that are just really interesting and fascinating. This is just a model to give you an idea of how, you know, there's one layer and they'll lift up one and show you what's underneath it. This is just a concept of what the stables probably looked like that you saw a little piece of. And we'll go to the next one. This just tells you that there's a public grain silo that they've unearthed here from the time of King Jeroboam II. And the silo had a capacity of 450 cubic meters. Straw was found between the stones to test to the function of the installation. So here's what an old farmer's silo looked like. Huge. They knew how to build stuff then, didn't they? I mean, that thing is still there. You know, it's just amazing to me. And then this is a water shaft that's attributed to King Ahab that he drilled down, and you get to go down into the thing and actually see. I mean, to get water was like a serious thing back in those days. I think it was about 182 steps down and another 80 back up. Of course, they've put new steps in there. That was probably, in certain respects, you could look at that since Solomon had a palace there. Solomon was really at the golden age of these people's history. God called Abram. We know that they ended up in Egypt, then they got delivered, and then they came back to their land, and Joshua took it, and they started building up, and that kind of peaked with Solomon. And things were going great, but then it sort of took a downward spiral after that. And things started getting worse and worse, and then eventually the north, the kingdom divided, just like America did, into north and south, except that we were able to reunify. Israel never did. They remained split. The north fell in around 700-something B.C., and then finally, in 586 B.C., 586 years before Jesus, the Babylonian Empire, which is, again, modern-day Iraq, still in the Bible, comes in, levels the place, kills a lot of people, brings back a lot of people to their empire right there in Iraq. And, you know, you hear about these things and you think, you know, did that really happen? And did they really go in there? And did they really take the Jews and bring them back to Babylon? And then we read in Ezra and Nehemiah that the next king, about 70 years later, Cyrus, gives them permission to go back and start rebuilding. But not all the Jews went back. So what happened to them? If some went back and some stayed in Babylon, what happened to them? They're still there, some of them. Did you ever think about that? How did they get there? The guy who was our tour guide, Shlomo, now that is a Jewish guide, if I ever heard one, huh? His parents, what they call Aliyah, when you come back to your homeland, your motherland as a Jewish person, came back to Israel in 1952 from Iraq. So I'm thinking that's fascinating. It's a very good chance that his family was in Iraq since Babylon came in and leveled Jerusalem in 586, brought him back, and his family was there for almost 2,500 years, and then they finally came back to Israel. Isn't it? They're still around. They're still left in places where they were taken captive. They're still a people. God's still working with them. It's still a physical witness to us that God's real and He's working in the planet right amongst us. Well, as their time went on and they came back and they rebuilt, and they, as always throughout Jewish history, they're struggling for survival, constantly being bombarded, and then there was wars and beyond rumors of wars until finally around 60-something, Rome got their chance to be ruling over Israel. So many different empires ruled over Israel, and they were always a pain in the neck because they never wanted to listen to earthly kings. The only one they wanted to really submit to was God and His Word. So they were always a hassle to whatever empire was trying to keep control of them. So this particular ruler that Rome put over Israel at this time, Herod had an idea. He said, you know what? There's such a pain in the neck. Maybe if I kind of meet them halfway. I mean, we've already beat them. They've been dominating over them for about 20 years, but maybe to get more than just their obedience, but maybe get their heart a little bit, I'll do a little bit of, if you can't beat them, join them. So he takes their whole area of Jerusalem and redoes the whole area for them. Rebuilds their temple and makes it the most amazing and beautiful structure pretty much in all that whole area of Israel to try and win their favor maybe a little bit. And he probably did some of the leadership. They liked him, those that were interested in political control and power. But for the most part, the people were not happy with him. But here's a couple pictures just to give you an idea. This is the most famous area that you've probably ever seen, and this is called the Western Wall. The part of this wall is still from when Herod redid Jerusalem. These rocks here, you can see how big they are. Those are original retaining wall that Herod had built. Now, when you go up further, you notice that they're smaller, and those were rocks that were put there in the 1500s during the Crusades when the wall was rebuilt. But those rocks, and here's one underneath the foundation, what they've done now is they've tunneled underneath so you can go see the original foundations. And just to give you an idea of the building project, the impressive, just go back one, Mike. The next one after that. That's it. Just stay there. To give you an idea of the massive building project that Herod did, this guy here is at the end of this particular block. That's how huge it is. They had even a thing to try and explain how the heck they did it. What they did, they showed was logs like telephone poles where you could roll the huge stone across the logs and they'd put them in front of it so you could keep it rolling until they could get it into place. I mean, it's crazy. The slave power that he had to have. And what happens is, even like in Megiddo, one empire comes in, levels the place. Now, they didn't have demolition companies you could call in and haul away the trash and then start over. So they just level the place and build on top of it. Then another, these people are as bad as us, you know. Then they start fighting. We just had, you know, like after we leveled Germany, then we cleared it out and rebuilt it. But back then, they didn't bother. They just leveled it out and built on top of that until you end up with a hill. Well, when the Romans leveled, they didn't bother to clear anything out. So the bottom of this wall is buried, but now they've tunneled underneath, so we can actually go down and see underneath some of the original foundations and even some pavement that more than likely Jesus probably even walked on, which is really cool. You just see how it's all historically documented stuff, and I'm going to just end with a story in Luke 4. If you want to turn to Luke chapter 4, Herod cleaned up Jerusalem, built it into an amazing place, and it was this setting that Jesus comes on the scene. It was this setting that Jesus is born into. I think it's something we're going to talk about more next week, but I think something that is happening in the church right now is a result of our advances in archaeological digs and understanding that we're more accurate in our history, and that understanding is leading into the church that we're beginning to understand our Hebraic roots, our Jewish roots, which is fascinating. And it's amazing when you read the Bible, it's like, how did these people read the Bible and not realize how Jewish it is? But somehow we managed. Verse 14 of chapter 4, I want to look at. Now this is Jesus, he's been born, he's grown up, he's gone into the desert, he's had his temptations with the devil, resisted the devil, as you know, through scripture, quotation, the power of the Spirit, and when he comes out of there, man, he's ready. It says, verse 14, and Jesus returned to Galilee in the power of the Spirit, and news about him spread through all the surrounding district, and he began teaching in their synagogues. How did they miss that? How did they miss where the roots, our spiritual roots, came from, that we actually managed to turn it into an anti-Semitic expression for hundreds, for century after century? He didn't go into the churches, he went into the synagogues. And he was praised by all. Verse 16, and he came to Nazareth. You can go to the next one there, Michael. That's what Nazareth looks like today. It's a lot bigger. It used to be more like Point Lookout when Jesus was there. Just a little town, just to give you a... go back one, Mike. Just to give you an idea, this is a significant site that's called the Church of the Annunciation. That is supposedly where the angel spoke to Mary that she was going to have a child. Now, I say supposedly because, you know, we're not sure and so much time has passed. Helena, who was the mother of Constantine in the 300s, went back to the holy area and asked, where did this happen? Where did that happen? Because Christianity was illegal before then. Lots of times they would build a temple to their gods so that hopefully Jesus would be forgotten. One was built in Bethlehem over the site where supposedly he was born, but by them doing that, they actually marked the spot, and so they were able to build a church over it. How accurate they are, well, we're going to see. It's kind of fascinating. I used to just kind of blow the whole thing off, but oral tradition is perhaps a lot stronger than we realize. And some of the areas that were marked and how it was carried down, oh yeah, that happened over here. Oh, that? Yeah, that happened here. And the way the guide put it is it's a 1, 2, or a 3. A 3 is this location, I'm not so sure. A 2 is maybe. 1 is a definite. And there's some 1s. There's quite a few 1s. It's interesting. So this town, a lot smaller at this time. They did find ruins of a synagogue there. They're kept in a Franciscan center now. There's some pillars and poles from that particular synagogue. Could have been the synagogue that Jesus went into. Very possibly. So he went in, it says he entered the synagogue, he came to Nazareth, verse 16. He had been brought up, and as was his custom, he entered the synagogue on the Sabbath and stood up and read, and the book of the prophet Isaiah was handed to him, and he opened the book and found the place where it was written. Now, why he was handed the book of Isaiah, they used to have readings in synagogue, probably still do, just like in traditional churches. You have a particular reading each week. You know, we don't do that, but a lot of churches do. Synagogue would have that. Now, perhaps the reading of Isaiah, it just so happened that reading was scheduled for this Sabbath. And there's Jesus ready to read it. They hand him the scroll, and here's the Spirit of the Lord is upon me because he anointed me to preach the gospel to the poor. He has sent me to proclaim release to the captives and recovery of sight to the blind, to set free those who are oppressed, to proclaim the favorable year of the Lord. That was known as a messianic text. That was known that was talking about the Messiah, the one that they were all waiting for, even the Roman Empire, even Herod had tried to win their favor. They still looked at it as just another empire that was oppressing them, and they were waiting for the Messiah to come deliver them. And here comes this kid who is now a young man, walks in, and he reads this scripture about the Messiah. In verse 20, it says that he closed the book, rolled up the scroll, gave it back to the attendant, and the way I understood it was they had one seat where they sat, they were handed the word to read it, and then if they were going to be the one to expound on what they read, they would sit in another seat from which they would expound from. So he sat down, all the eyes are in the synagogue are fixed on him. He's got a reputation that has been building. He's already turned the water into wine in Cana. Another event has happened, we'll talk about in. And so they're like, well, what is he going to tell us about the Messiah? This text is about the Messiah who's going to come and deliver us out of the oppressive empires. What will he say? And he began, verse 21, to say to them, today, this scripture has been fulfilled in your hearing. In other words, he's saying, guess what, gang? I'm him. I'm here. What? Yeah. Yeah, verse 22, and all were speaking well of him, but then they're wondering at the gracious words which were falling from his lips, and they were saying, wait a minute, isn't this Joseph's son? Joseph, more than likely, most scholars think, was probably dead by now. Mary is a widow. So they're talking about him, maybe referring to him in the past tense, but meanwhile, he was a tacitan, a carpenter. That really was probably more about carving stones. You see, most stuff was made out of stones. There's even a town not too far from there, Chorazin, where they think Joseph very well could have carved a lot of the stones in the buildings there and probably showed his son Jesus how to do it. They're saying, wait a minute, this guy's just a carpenter. What are you talking about? And he said to them, no doubt you're going to quote this proverb to me, physician, heal yourself. Whatever we heard was done at Capernaum then, do here in your hometown as well. See, he had already done a miracle in Capernaum that they had heard about, things that he had done, and now they're saying, Jesus, do it here. Did you ever notice when Jesus, I like the way you put it, Paul, when Jesus is ever put on the spot and asked to do a card trick, he's not going to do it. Because this isn't about card tricks and me displaying my power. It's about you coming to know that there's a God that is incredibly in love and cares about you. And I'm not going to heal somebody because you need a card trick to see if you're going to believe. I will heal them if that person really just honestly believes that I am who I am and I can deliver them out of such an oppressive, horrible state because I care about people. I don't care about impressing anyone, Jesus says. As a matter of fact, don't even go there if you really let my example be what speaks for me. So they got mad, and it says, verse 28, and all the people in the synagogue were filled with rage as they heard these things. And they got up, and they drove him out of the city and led him to a brow on the hill on which their city had been built in order to throw him down the cliff. But passing through their midst, he went away. This next picture is believed to be the cliff. And thank God nobody's trying to throw us off at that point. Because I don't know if I could do Jesus' deal, and somehow he got out of it. You know what's wild, though? And you're going to see, it may make you think twice a little about some of this oral tradition. I'm going to just end with something in a minute. But I tell you, when you see where the town of Nazareth is and where this cliff is, it wasn't like, you know, across the street. It was like a mile away. I mean, they had to drag him along. It had to be an incredible rage that had taken over these people to take them so far and still want to, you know, you'd think by, you know, by mile two, you'd cool down a little bit and rethink about what you want to do. This is quite a ways away. That is the same valley that you saw from Megiddo, that picture I had in the beginning. It's just from a different angle. I think Nazareth is the south view and Megiddo is the north view, but that's that same Jezreel Valley. All those battles took place out there, and some believe that Armageddon will actually take place there. But that's where they dragged him. And he went his way, it says, verse 30. Then verse 31, it says, he left there, he was rejected there, he went to inaugurate his ministry, he was rejected, so he goes to Capernaum. Verse 31, and he came down to Capernaum, a city of Galilee, and he was teaching them on the Sabbath, and they were amazed at his teaching, for his message was with authority. In the synagogue there was a man possessed of the Spirit. In the synagogue. Let's go to the next one, Michael. This is in Capernaum. This is a synagogue. Now, when you first see it, you're like, wow, is this it? You know? But it ends up that this was probably built somewhere between 300 to 400, about, you know, 200 or 300 years after Jesus. It was destroyed in 600 during the Muslim Crusades. But usually when they rebuilt a site, it was always over the old site. It was considered like holy ground. So they dug underneath this, and they found the ruins of a first century synagogue. Very possibly the one where Jesus had preached in. But it's kind of cool because this gives you an idea of an ancient synagogue. You can see how some of the stones on the exterior are smoother than the ones in the middle. The ones in the middle are original. And you know what? It made me feel better about our church, too, because carved in some of the pillars was like in-memory stuff of people that had donated, you know? So we're not the only ones that have that stuff on the pews, you know? They had them back in Jesus' the synagogue that Jesus went to, you know? But and they even had a fellowship hall on the other side. And there's one more, next one, just an exterior view. It was, as you can see, the stones that they really built with were a darker, I think they call it a basalt type stone. And so it was limestone they made the synagogue out of, which they had to have some serious money to do. And back in Jesus' time, probably the same thing was true, because if you look in Luke 7, you find out that the guy who funded the synagogue, that Jesus was here performing this miracle, was not even a Jew. He was a centurion. He was a Roman centurion. Remember that? And they came to him. He had a servant that was suffering, one of his best servants that he loved, and he sent some of his guys to go talk to the elders of this particular synagogue and said, hey, listen, you know, he sent the Kevin and the Joel and the Greg of that particular synagogue to go to Jesus and say, listen, this guy, we love this guy. He's the one who really funded our synagogue. And his servant's about to die. Will you come and pray for his servant? And Jesus said, yes. And they probably thought, yeah, man, I knew once we told him that he had funded the synagogue, Jesus would come. But we find out later the reason Jesus probably came is because this centurion had such amazing faith. By the time he started to almost arrive there, he said, Jesus, listen, you're not even worthy to come into my house. I'm a man who has charge over 100 guys, and when I tell one to do that, they go do it. You have charge over everything. You can tell that disease to leave my servant. You don't even have to physically be there. And he says, wow, it's not about what you donated. It's about what's in here. You go home. This guy's already healed. So now Jesus goes into this back town there, and he's at this synagogue on the Sabbath. And in verse 32, it says, they were amazed at his teaching. Verse 33, in the synagogue there was a man possessed of the spirit of an unclean demon. He cried out with a loud voice, let us alone. What business do you have with each other, Jesus of Nazareth? You've come to destroy us. I know who you are, the Holy One of God. That always freaks you out, doesn't it? The demons know who he is, but the people don't. They believed. So I always say, you know, you can know the truth, but it doesn't necessarily get you to heaven. I don't expect to see Satan in heaven. His demons knew exactly who he were. Rebuked him, saying, be quiet, come out of him. And they were just freaked out. This guy who was just a crazy, demon-possessed person is now whole. He's whole. Verse 38, it says that then he got up and left the synagogue and entered Simon's home. I love that verse. The Bible just shatters all our traditions, because traditionally, a lot of us from our Catholic tradition believe that Peter was the first pope. Well, that's I have no problem with that. He was the first leader of the church. Jesus says, upon this rock I build my church. But he wasn't talking about Peter, he's talking about the statement he made. But nevertheless, we see here that Peter, if he was the first pope, it's kind of cool. He was Jewish and he was married. So next time somebody's sarcastic, you know when you make a statement and they think it's like a ridiculous statement, they're like, yeah, right, and the pope's Jewish. You can go, he actually was the first one. And here it is. So they get to Simon's home, Peter. They see Simon's mother-in-law was suffering from a high fever, and they asked him to help her. Standing over her, he rebuked the fever, and it left her, and she immediately got up and waited on them. Now, this was another town where oral tradition for centuries. Peter's house, it was right over there. Oh, okay, let's mark it. Then 300, Constantine's mother comes there, builds a church over the supposed site. Some empire comes in and wipes that out, and then eventually they let some other Christian group build another church, and then they get wiped out, and a few centuries later, you know, and you end up with like some of these places, like 3 to 5 churches have been built one on top of the other with all the wars that went on. And they started digging, and they went through and they saw the Byzantine, and they went through and then they saw the one that was built in the 300s, and they said, well, let's just go one more layer. And they went and they found a house. So sometimes you wonder, man, maybe the oral tradition is a little more strength to it than what we sometimes credit to it. But it is crazy, the length of time we're talking about. She went there 300 years later to start marking spots. Could you imagine if in another 70 years we go to Washington and try and figure out to mark the spot where George Washington had his home? Because we're not even up to 300 years old yet, you know? But oral tradition has proved many times to find a site, and there it is. Last thing I want to just kind of leave you with is in Matthew 11, verse 23. All these amazing miracles were done in Capernaum. And Jesus said this, Matthew 11, verse 23. He said, "And you, Capernaum," you could go to the next one, Michael, I'm sorry. That's, one back. That's what they found. That they built a church on stilts so you could look underneath it, and that's the ruins of the house they found, perhaps Peter's house. It's believed to have been the location for thousands of years. When they finally got through everything, they found an ancient house, ruins of an ancient house. Verse 23, Jesus said this to this town that had seen all these miracles, done all these things, and he said, "And you, Capernaum, will not be exalted to heaven, will you? You will descend to Hades. For if the miracles had occurred in Sodom, which occurred in you, it would have remained to this day. Nevertheless, I say to you that it will be more tolerable for you for the land of Sodom in the day of judgment than for you." You know, sometimes I get frustrated and I think, man, they had such an unfair advantage. They got to see all of these miracles and everything, you know. And if I seen that stuff, then I'd be able to just, you know, go full force headlong into the living for Jesus. But we see here, didn't work for these people. They still didn't follow. You know, there's something about when God meets us and transforms our ability to believe. It's an inner work that God does. And we have no more of an unfair circumstance than the people of the first century. They had all this evidence and they fell into a place where they didn't even believe. Remember what he said to Thomas? "You believe because you've seen. Blessed are those who believe and have not seen." Well, many did see and they still didn't believe. I think I have one more picture here. That's just the Sea of Galilee. That's right outside Capernaum. So many of Jesus' disciples came from this town. Peter, Andrew, James, and John, even Matthew came from Capernaum. He used to collect taxes there because there that a trade route, Via Maris, used to go right through there, probably collected taxes for people bringing stuff in. That's the sea where Jesus is said to have walked on, where he calmed the waves. And then lastly, I'm going to just end with this. This is a one. Remember I said ones that are the site that's actually there? That's looking from the Garden of Gethsemane, and you see the olive branches? Those olive trees, I never knew this. Did you know that olive trees technically don't die? You could even cut them and they'll regrow. And if you want to know how old they are, you don't go by cutting them and counting the rings. You go by the girth of the trunk. And there's at least two trees there that the girth of the trunk is the size that they have to be at least 2,000 years old. So more than likely, they were trees that were there when Jesus prayed. And they know that was the garden because that has always been a place for meditation and prayer for Jewish people. And so you look from there and you see this is the Eastern Gate. That is the gate that Jesus went through when he came into Jerusalem on Palm Sunday. Now, it's the exact same location, different gate. That particular archways that you see there were built during the Crusades of the 1500s and then filled in because The story goes that the Muslims knew that the Messiah would come through the Eastern Gate, so they filled it in with brick and mortar, and then put a cemetery in front of it. It's full of tombs, because they understood that Jewish people can't walk past the dead, but the law actually prescribes that only for the tribe of Levi, and Jesus is from the tribe of Judah, but it doesn't much matter because he already came and he walked through there. But he's coming back. That's what the Bible says. The Bible told us all this other stuff, man. We can go, we can find the locations. So many of it is verifiable. If we know that it's been verified what it said in the past, maybe we better start taking a little more seriously what it says about the future and what life is all about. And we're going to talk about that next week. All right? Let's pray.